whenever my world falls apart. I never lose hope or lose heart. Whatever the form of the storm that may brew, not with you to lean on, darling's you.
Hello and welcome to The Original Cast, a podcast about original cast albums and the people who love them. I'm Patrick Flynn. My guest today, you've heard him on NPR. He's written a book about Superman called The Unauthorized Biography. But you're probably most familiar with him because of his arch nemesis, Chris Klimek, and their podcast about The Prisoner, A Degree Absolute. It's Glenn Weldon, everybody.
Hey, thanks for having me, man.
Of course. Thank you for being had, as they say. Because you're here to talk about...
My Fair Lady.
The rain in Spain stays mainly in the plain.
I think she's got it. I think she's got it.
The rain in Spain stays mainly in the plain.
By George, she's got it. By George, she's got it. Now, once again, where does it rain?
On the plain, on the plain.
And where's that soggy plain?
In Spain, in Spain.
Which I don't think you've done on the podcast before, correct?
No, this is our third Lerner and Lowe. We've done Brigadoon.
Sure.
And Alexandra Petri came in with Camelot. But we've never done My Fair Lady. The musical that you told me in an email made you gay. So
how did
My Fair Lady come into your life?
Well, I mean, look, if we're talking favorite, My Heart Belongs to Little Shop, but you've done that several times.
Mm-hmm.
But My Fair Lady was seminal, and I don't mean that the dirty way. It helped shape me. There's a lot to unpack here. My parents had the cast album. They weren't particularly musical people per se, but they were teenagers in the 50s. God love them, they were more Pat Boone than Elvis, right?
Wow.
I mean, so
yeah.
Two roads diverged in the wood and they took the road more basic.
They took the
yeah. And
America's answer to Cliff Richard.
Exactly. That's exactly the pull. Their collection really wasn't deep, but they were kind of a piece. They had a Jim Nabors. They had a Tennessee Ernie Ford. They had Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass.
But not the dirty one.
They had Roger Miller, King of the Road, and they had the soundtrack to Exodus, to two films, Exodus and Windjammer, a film I've never heard of, which is about a ship, apparently.
Huh.
They had the Barbara Streisand Christmas album. That's the only Barbara Streisand they had.
Sure.
You'd think that would have been what turned me gay, upsot, but no, it was the two cast albums. One was Camelot, the other was My Fair Lady.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. And when I got my own record player in the fifth grade, I played two albums over and over again. Superman, the movie soundtrack. I would stand in my room and conduct it like I was a little fifth grade John Williams.
Right.
I was off book on Can You Read My Mind from the jump. and My Fair Lady. And here's a thing that I'm just going to put out there. I'm not proud of it, but it's part of me. I identified so strongly with Rex Harrison's Henry Higgins. And that's sad because he's a dick. But there's a rather tragic through line in my life to fictional figures that I identify with. You're Henry Higgins. You're your Charles Emerson Winchesters.
Oh.
You're Fraser / Niles Cranes and your Sideshow Bobs. If you had to pull that thread,
that is a hell of a Venn diagram.
It's actually a circle, actually, because they're all pompous pseudo intellectual pricks, right? They're all kind of stuffed shirts, and that's my wheelhouse, I guess. I don't know.
They're also all really good at their job.
Okay,
I mean, that's Sideshow Bob, maybe notwithstanding,
true.
But sort of.
Oh, Sideshow Bob is great at his job. Like I would watch. The Sideshow Bob version of Krusty the Clown much more than
I
watch Krusty.
Oh, yes, my young friends. but, like, the defining characteristic for... I mean, Higgins is obviously the preeminent... One of the two preeminent in his field of linguists, the other being Pickering, who also comes from India to meet him.
Yep.
But Winchester in MASH, the thing that made him such a great departure for me from Frank Burns is that he was an excellent... surgeon.
Right.
That's where his pomposity comes from a lot of places, but mainly it comes from his work.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's excellent at his job, as he says, I do one thing at a time. I do it very well, and then I move on.
Yes, he did.
And so that's an interesting through line also, I think, among some of those, at least some of them, that they're perfectionists in their work as well as being sort of sad pompous figures.
Yeah. I think Niles is probably better at his job than Frasier is. Frasier is...
yeah, you know, that's true.
I think that's the thing. But have you ever, Patrick, seen the 1990 film Jeffrey?
I have pulled that up since you mentioned My Fair Lady turning you gay
there
because
you
of the
go.
Record. Because, yes, that is a definitive scene in that movie. So, yes.
It's the scene you remember. It's the only thing you really pull out of that. Because, I mean, that's like a B-minus rom-com, right? And it's a 1990 film starring Steven Weber as a gay man in New York who decides he's going to stop having sex because of AIDS. Or it's actually more he wants to not have a relationship because he'll fall in love and then he'll lose, blah, 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 blah.
Right.
But at one point he does go to a church. He gets hit on by a priest played by Nathan Lane, who is just making a meal out of that.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, that scenery had no chance.
Yeah, none.
Not a chance.
And Jeffrey is all like, why does God let bad things happen? And Lane gets this incredible monologue where he says, I'm going to tell you what your conception of God is. And he pulls out the original My Fair Lady cast album and points to the illustration on the cover. I think it's an Al Hirschfeld illustration.
It is an Al Hirschfeld, yes.
It's drawing of George Bernard Shaw up in the clouds and Rex Harrison's Henry Higgins and Julie Andrews' Eliza Doolittle. Below, he says,
here's how you see God. He's a Columbia recording artist. You got your idea, God, where most gay kids get it. My Fair Lady, original cast. See, George Bernard Shaw up in the clouds manipulating Rex Harrison and Julie Andrews on strings. It was your parents' album. You were little. You thought it was a picture of God.
Yeah.
Well, you were almost there because God is on this record. Lerner and Lowe. Why count the English? Wouldn't it be lovely? I'm telling you, the only times I really feel the presence of God are when I'm having sex and during a great Broadway musical.
It was 1995 when I saw that movie. I had just come out at age 25. I hadn't expected to be kind of pole-axed by that description. But, man, I spent so much time staring at that cast album and that illustration in particular. And, again, I was probably the only sixth grader in Westchester, Pennsylvania who was off book on Why Can't the English. But I wasn't real. Okay, that's the thing. I wasn't off book on Henry Higgins. I was off book on Rex Harrison's Henry Higgins. His intonation, his phrasing, his inflection. But, you know, this is a guy. I mean, I couldn't sing. I still can't sing, but and neither can he. But he makes a go of it, right?
He does.
He hits the notes without holding them, which is the secret to that. And he does have... When we talk about the individual songs, he does have this kind of clarion brass instrument quality to his voice when he hits things like, why can't the English? Like, it's so clear. It's so clear. And, that was... So anyway, that scene, it stops you. It stops you dead in your tracks, if you're a me.
He does, you know, he gets a lot of guff for not singing. But he certainly sings more on this recording than he does in the movie.
Yeah, that's true.
In the movie, he is really talk singing, rhythmic speaking.
How much older is he in the movie?
Ooh, that's
movie?
A good question. Well, the movie is 8 years later,
okay,
I think.
There you go.
Yeah. I mean, it's 56, and the movie's, what, 64? Is that right? So he's 8 years, yeah. So that's 8 years. Oh my gosh, I was right.
Yep.
So he's almost a decade older, and actually a decade older, having done this show on Broadway for a really long time, and then having then done it on the West End for a very long time. So this was sort of his late career, you know, defining role. He was 56 when the movie came out.
Wow.
And,
I mean. I should say that, like, I went back just this last week. I have not listened to this cast album in decades, so I went back and listened this week to refresh my memory, and it started, and it felt weird. It felt off to me slightly, just vaguely unsatisfying. On the surface, it's exactly as I remembered, but as I kept going on, and this was most notable during the Harrison numbers, which are my favorite numbers in the show, I thought he was making different phrasings than I had kind of... internalized, because this album was written on my soul, because I just listened to it so often.
Why can't the English teach their children how to speak? This verbal class distinction by now should be antique. If you spoke as she does, sir, instead of the way you do, why, you might be selling flowers, too.
I beg your pardon, sir.
And then I looked at the cover, and it was exactly the same one, the same illustration, the same font, everything. And it said original Broadway cast. And I was like, okay, so this is the same album. And it wasn't a reissue. It wasn't like an encore performance or a command performance or anything. But it was a different color than I remember.
Yeah. Oh.
And then I did a search.
Yeah.
And I found that what I had thought for going on 40 years was the original Broadway cast was, in fact, the original London cast.
Yes.
Recording. And so I just, you know, I found that on Spotify, and as soon as I hit play, I can't tell you the visceral satisfaction, this kind of muscle memory that just came back.
Why can't the English teach their children how to speak? This verbal class distinction by now should be antique. If you spoke as she does, sir, instead of the way you do, why, you might be selling flowers too.
I beg your pardon, sir.
An Englishman's way of speaking absolutely classifies him. The moment he talks, he makes some other Englishman despise him. One common language I'm afraid we'll never get. Oh, why can't the English learn to set a good example to people whose English is painful to your ears? The Scotch and the Irish leave you close to tears. There even are places where English completely disappears. Well, in America, they haven't used it for years.
It's amazing that Andrews and Harrison both had kind of settled in and were playing a little bit more. If you compare the two, they are practiced and they're having maybe a bit more fun because they're just, it's like they're put their toe in their shoe and they're just kind of wiggling their toes. The dude playing Pickering, though, was unchanged. It's like hitting play on a record or like on a record.
Yeah.
He's just like, chikunk. He does exactly the same thing. I beg your pardon, so with exactly the same phrasing.
And Robert Coote is that actor's name.
Yep.
Who I only know because, they have those great, on Wikipedia, the chart of, like, who played who, when, and which famous production and all that. He played Pickering in Broadway and West End, just like Harrison and Andrews did. But then he also played Pickering in the 76 revival on Broadway.
Oh, boy.
You'd think he'd want to be promoted, he's not a name, but you think, I'll play a different part. No, he played Pickering a lot.
Yeah.
And I get the impression he played it that way.
Uh-huh.
A lot. And,
but in the movie, it was Wilfred Hyde White, right?
Yes.
Yeah. I wonder why. You need a big name like Wilfred Hyde White.
Absolutely. and the movie cast is great, even though most of them aren't doing their own. I mean, no one's doing their own singing, I guess, because Rex Harrison isn't singing. I guess Stanley Holloway does his own singing.
Oh, sure.
And you have the inimitable Marnie Nixon dubbing dubbing Audrey Hepburn.
Yep.
And Sherlock Holmes is Jeremy Brett, which is a fun one in the movie.
Uh-huh.
Yes, so that's the funny fact about this record, this show, is that the Broadway cast album was a huge hit and big number one in the Billboard charts for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks. But Playbill, not too long ago, published a list of the top, I think, 50 best-selling cast albums of all time.
Mm-hmm.
And the one that was on the list for My Fair Lady, the number, 12, is the London cast recording. For whatever reason, that one sold more units. Hey, everybody. Just dropping in here to say that after Glenn and I finished our conversation, I went back and read the Playbill article again that Logan Caldwell Block wrote on the best-selling cast albums of all time, which you can find a link to in the show notes. And Logan, because he's Logan, explained that the reason the London cast sold more units than the Broadway version is that the Broadway version was recorded in mono, and the London version was recorded in stereo, which was still relatively new at the time and therefore was pushed more by the record company and sold more units overall than the Broadway cast album, even though the Broadway cast album was on the Billboard charts for longer. So that is why the London recording is the one you will generally find instead of the Broadway one. The London one, again, has the kind of brownish cover and the Broadway one has the white cover. And I think you're right. I think it has a slight... That's also the one I had. When I did My Fair Lady in high school, That was the cast album that my parents got me to get ready for the show. So mm-hmm. that's the one I'm familiar with as well.
Right.
And it has a little more whimsy, I think, to it, and a little more sense of fun than the Broadway one does.
Yeah, I think Harrison especially is playing with where the line sits in the line, I guess, mm-hmm. where the words sit in the line.
Mm-hmm.
Just a little bit more. He's sometimes pulling back. He's sometimes really delaying it and letting the orchestration get ahead of him and then kind of rushing to finish it up. It's just, it's when you've been doing something a kajillion times, you are trying mm-hmm. to make it interesting for yourself while sticking to the thing. I also think they just knew these characters inside and out by that point.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I mean, you can kind of hear it on, and I just, you know, when Why Can't the English starts, and there's that fanfare, that kind of, you know, let loose the hounds, right? That mm-hmm. kind of like the games afoot kind of ness of it all. It's just, sure. it's so stirring. And there is so much character infused into that song. He's not just showing off, although he is doing that.
Mm-hmm.
He's really just bitching. He's just complaining. He's just yes. despairing that no one is on his level. No one understands the problem that he is identifying. And there's a real gusto to his delivery. There's relish. There's, you know, and one of my favorite moments in that song is when Pickering says, "Oh, come, sir, I think you picked a poor example." And he
right.
hits, "Did I?" There, you can hear the sneer. You can hear it. It's he's having such fun. And then when he says, "In America, they haven't used it for years," and he launches oh, back in, why? That's the yeah. trumpet sound. That's like he's going for it. And, you know, there's some really chewy lyrics in there, like, "Here are Yorkshiremen or worse, here two Cornishmen converse." I mean, that's
oh, what is, yeah. What are you and this is Alan that? J. Lerner having his best time, I think, in this. That song, but this show especially, he has wonderful turns of phrase, internal rhyming, jumping around. He's having so much fun with this character who can talk. I mean, right. who really, really can talk. And he really obviously just adores letting him do it. Even though, I mean, I love that song, but he is, God, he's a snob. I mean,
yeah.
just my
yep.
God, he's
yep.
a snob.
Yep.
It is the, like, it's just... It's incredible. The more I think about it, the more of like how it's not even unlikable. He's just a snob. Like, he's not likable or unlikable. He's our hero, and he's a snob, and that's kind of his deal. And it's good because we're going to watch as the show goes on this snobbish veneer get torn at
uh-huh.
and pulled and beaten and destroyed through its own pomposity, which is always the way you want to see a snob torn apart, is by their own doing.
And if you didn't have Pickering there as his elderly boy wonder, there could be no empathy for this guy because he is just so off-putting.
Mm-hmm.
And Pickering is there to be sympathetic, but also he is, you know, objectifying Eliza just as much as Henry's doing. Like,
he
is using her in exactly the same way. He's just nicer about it, which makes yeah. him almost more sinister. There's more going on with him.
Well, and his last line, Pickering's last line in the show, is always just like when Eliza's gone missing and they're going to try uh-huh. to find her, and Mrs. Pierce says, "Oh, Mr. Higgins will miss her so much." And he says, "Blast Higgins, I'll miss her," and walks out the door. And you're like, oh,
yeah.
What is that? What exactly does that mean?
That's right. I'm sure
Colonel
he hit it.
Pickering?
I'm sure he hit it exactly the same way every night.
Oh, I'm sure. Man, hit his with like a metronome. He had those marks.
He had those marks. And again,
I beg your pardon, so.
One of my favorite things about this is the way Rex Harrison is an R triller. Just like a certain Patrick Magoon. So Arabians learn Arabian with the speed of summer
yes.
lightning. And the Hebrews learn it backwards, which is absolutely frightening.
Absolutely frightening.
And the absolutely is hit. And then there's a little bing. It's such a great song to situate us in. Okay, this guy's a dick. He knows a lot. We're going to be getting a lot of language stuff in this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we go to Wouldn't It Be Lovely, you know, that is the first I Want song I guess I'd ever really listened to.
Mm-hmm.
It is kind of a quintessential I Want song because mm-hmm. she's just sitting
she
there.
Says.
All I want is a room somewhere far away from the cold night air with one enormous chair. Wouldn't it be lovely? Lots of chocolate lots of it. Warm face, warm hands, warm feet. Wouldn't it be lovely?
I'm not as much a fan of the kind of slower ballads. They're perfectly lovely melodies. But it's the kind of... it's Harrison's sort of verbal pyrotechnics that I kind of really get off.
Well, and it's the thing that I think as I go through the Lerner and Lowe's work, like shows like Brigadoon, I find just interminably boring because mm-hmm. it is a lot of that.
Yeah.
And there's some beautiful melodies and songs in Brigadoon, but it is a slog of slow, meaningful, mournful ballads.
I couldn't name, besides the, you know, the main one.
Right, which I can't. I was trying to think of as well, and I'm coming up short.
Yeah.
But it. So yeah. Aside from the hit that neither of us can think of the name of at the moment.
What a day this has been! What a rare mood I'm in! Why it's almost like being in love.
It is just kind of a wash, that score to me. Camelot is a little more. There's some longing ballads, and you know, could I leave you? And they're not could I leave you. That's Sondheim. It's a would I leave you? Uh-huh. But there's, you know, songs like C'est Moi and the fun, you know, like bouncy stuff. But this is a great balance of fun, silly musical comedy songs and one or two lovely little. I mean, even songs like I Could Have Danced All Night, which is, you know, is funny, has that great counterpoint between the servants of, like, mm-hmm. trying to get her to go to bed. And it's pretty,
yeah.
It has the good, I will say, I haven't listened to this in many, many, many years either. And because I did it in high school and I have the kind of memory where that means, like, every beat in this show is burned into my spine.
Mm-hmm.
But throwing it on again to listen to it, to talk to you, it was refreshing. It was like a really cold drink on a hot day. Uh-huh. And I have always been one who in my sort of dramaturgical snobbiness have espoused that Pygmalion is better than My Fair Lady in the sense of the way it tells the story.
Huh.
I think that Pygmalion, and it certainly has a better ending. Yeah. I will defend that till the end of time. Mm-hmm. But listening to the score, I was reminded that now this is a really, really good musical. Like, this is really good.
Hot take coming in
fresh off the. It is so much. There are things, issues with it. It's very much of its time and needs to be handled in a way that addresses those problems while letting the quality of it shine. But it is really, like, there's a reason people keep wanting to do it and play those parts.
Mm-hmm.
It is a very, very well-written show. And right. that kind of took me off guard, which is just because I hadn't really given it a serious thought since I was, you know, 14 years old, probably.
Right. And the next song, with a little bit of luck.
The Lord above gave man an arm of iron so he could do his job and never shirk. The Lord above gave man an arm of iron, but with a little bit of luck, with a little bit of luck, someone else will do the blinking work. With a little bit, with a little bit, with a little bit of luck, you'll never work.
You get the right guy in that part, and you win your audience over immediately. They are going to.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
I didn't even know.
Yep. It was one of the great 14-year-old Doolittles.
Well, you know, you could see it in your eyes, your world weary.
Yeah, like the twinkle, right?
Yeah, the twinkle. See, right. I kind of always.
Drunken Irishman.
I kind of always hated that character because I was a rule follower as a kid. I was a goody two-shoes, mm-hmm. and I just didn't approve of this. And it was like, well, you know, we shouldn't be glorifying this. I would say to myself in my darkened bedroom, well, this just seems irresponsible.
Right. What a wild human being.
But I can tell, like, the charm is... I mean, of course, Stanley Holloway is great. But, I mean, charm is encoded into the lyrics, into the wordplay, into... although, he is a dick to Eliza, and he is... It's... How did you make him charming? Because he is such a dick to Eliza.
I don't know. At 14, I don't think I was digging that deep into the character. I was just going for as many laughs as I could possibly get within the 25 minutes I was on stage or whatever.
And they're factory installed, those laughs.
They are. They absolutely are. And they are, I mean, it is one of those I had a teacher in college once who said there are certain roles that if you just say all the words and don't bump into the furniture, you'll get nominated for an award. Like, it's just, they're bulletproof. And Doolittle, to me, is a bulletproof role. Like, right. You can, it's really hard to mess him up. It's also hard to do him tremendously well, as most bulletproof roles are. They're kind of, they're hard, they're kind of set in amber a little bit. Mm-hmm. But he is just fun. And he's fun in a show full of people who are not intentionally fun. You know, Higgins and Pickering and Eliza are fun, but they don't mean to, like, they're having a terrible time with each other.
Yeah,
they're
yeah.
not having fun. We're having fun watching them not have fun. Uh-huh. But he is just out there living his life, doing his best self, living moment to moment. And then, of course, it all comes crashing down on him when someone... Because I love the fact thing about Doolittle that he predicts his own downfall. Again, uh-huh. I mean, that's the Shaw of it all. Uh-huh. But when uh-huh. he doesn't want too much money. When Higgins is going to write him a check, he's just like, no, don't give me that much. That's too much. If you give me that much, I'll have to, like, be a gentleman. Just uh-huh. give me enough to get 2 or 3 pints, and I'll be fine. I'll make the rest of it work.
Right.
And then Higgins accidentally endows him with a tremendous with an endowment from uh-huh. this guy in America, and he ruins his life, basically.
Yep. Yep. Yeah, it's
wonderful.
And Holloway's just, he'd been around for... So long, tromping the boards, and he finally lucked into this. I mean, yeah, people knew him in Britain, but wow, he just became a household name
based on
that. I can't imagine the number of times he must have done it on, like, Jack Parr or The Tonight Show or Ed Sullivan or whatever the hell. So this is, next up is I'm an Ordinary Man, and mm-hmm. I think Harrison gets, like, 6 songs that are kind of his in this show. 2 of them now read as incel anthems.
But let a woman in your life, and your serenity is through. She'll redecorate your home from the cellar to the dome, then go on to the enthralling fun of overhauling you. Let a woman in your life, and you're up against a wall. Make a plan and you will find she has something else in mind, and so rather than do either, you do something else that neither likes at all. You want to talk of Keats or Milton. She only wants to talk of love. You go to see a play or ballet and spend it searching for her glove. Let a woman in your life, and you invite eternal strife. Let them buy their wedding bands for those anxious little hands. I'd be equally as willing for a dentist to be drilling than to ever let a woman in my life.
Yes, there's a little bit of gay panic to it, but, like, it's he you couldn't get away with this now because it's just pure dripping misogyny that isn't really winked at to the extent. I mean, I think in Him to Him, it's really, really winked at. It's like he's underlined, like, yes, why can't a woman be more like you, like that? But here, I mean, he's still relishing it, right? He's still enjoying the hell out of this delusion that he's just Joe Sixpack, right?
Right.
We learn in this that it's kind of important to him that he be seen as just quiet.
Yes.
You know, so, humble, very gentle man. And then, you know, he punctuates it with things like, And everything goes to hell.
Tempo goes crazy. Yeah.
Tempo goes crazy, and you've got this sort of, like, I mean, literally it goes to hell. It's got that kind of, like, descent into the maelstrom effect. And the details in this song are so strangely specific. This random woman will have a large Wagnerian mother.
Right.
Which is, like, where'd that come from? And then you see that Alan J. Lerner was married 8 times. And you go, oh, okay.
Yes,
so
yes,
I see
yes,
where some of this misogyny might be coming from.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Alan J. Lerner.
Alan J. Lerner.
So many Oscars and so little work.
Yeah, and then it kind of apparently died... Not penniless, but not well off because
wasn't wise with his money.
Wasn't
wise with his money. So when you were, you know, yourself in the dark conducting these shows and play actually for this, you say you were playing Rex Harrison. Uh-huh. How did you find that? Did you find you were Rex Harrison in the world, and so having this show to listen to and to absorb sort of let you know you were not alone? Or was it just you found, like, this was fun to listen to because you agreed with this character in a sort of basic way?
Oh, not so much the latter, definitely the former. But, you know, I was a closeted kid. This was suburban Philadelphia. This was Westchester, Pennsylvania. This was, you listened to MMR, you listened to YSP, or you were a fag. And so you had to, like, the idea of show tunes of any kind, I mean, it was just as suspect as Michael Jackson. It was just as suspect as Duran Duran. Because there is this really stunted... a very small idea of masculinity that 14-year-old boys in suburban Philadelphia had. Maybe they've evolved. I don't think they have. But
they had a little bit by the 90s, I would say, but not that much.
Yeah,
certainly not in Catholic school.
No, I can only imagine. Right. So yeah, but I just thought it was fun, and I loved the bravura of this performance. And similarly, like this actually ties into the next one, which is Just You Wait. If Wouldn't It Be Loverly is a very pretty tune, but it's kind of a snooze, this is a bop because of the energy embedded in the lyrics, the rage, the, you know, it gives Liza some agency, and it's the one I keep going back to, not only because of, like, you know, fun things, your Henry Higgins Ed, although that is fun, but I love how you can see... Eliza has had a few lessons with Pickering and Higgins. And so when she tries to be posh in this song, I'll go to St. James so often I will call it St. Jim, she's not getting it yet. She doesn't have the ear yet. She's reaching for it. And it is a really good way to kind of see where she is how she's positioned in this show right now, because she's gotten a glimpse of what life could be like, but she has to go through this kind of troglodyte to get there. And naturally she feels the rage. If she didn't, if she was just a spineless, you know, toady, we'd fall instantly out of love with her.
Well, and just like him to him, or Ordinary Man, she goes way too far in her sort of thing she's going to do to Henry Higgins.
Just you wait until we're swimming in the sea. Ooh, Henry Higgins, and you get a cramp a little way from me. When you yell you're going to drown, I'll get dressed and go to town. Oh, Henry Higgins, oh, Henry Higgins, just you wait.
There's something under there that's kind of cooking, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
And from her dad and stuff, you see, like, kind of maybe where it's all been coming from all these years.
That's
but
true.
It's a nice parallel between the two characters who will eventually have to end up with each other, that there's similarities in the way they were, like, their outrageousness is very complimented.
And we're going to see in the last few songs of the show another kind of where these two songs talk to each other in a very important way to kind of put them on a level playing field, because otherwise the power dynamic would just make this, it's still problematic. Don't get me wrong.
Yes. Oh yes.
But there's a very smart juxtaposition between these two songs that kind of undercuts it. The next up is Rain in Spain. What can you say about this? This is like the musical theater equivalent of universal background radiation. It's inescapable. It's everywhere. I can't listen to it without just picking out, like, I can't pick out anything for it because it's all of a piece. You know what I mean? It's so that thing. It's the thing that everybody. It's when you say My Fair Lady, that's what people talk about. They don't talk about Loverly. They don't talk about, well, they grow accustomed to her face a little bit, but like this is the thing that epitomizes that is the emblem of this show.
Yes.
And I like it a lot, but you know, I can't listen to it.
Well, if you heard it once, you've heard it a thousand times. Like, it's not, there's nothing new to, and every time I've seen it staged, it's staged almost exactly the same way every single time.
Oh, the bull. Yes.
That's in the script. Like, there's nothing you can do with it. Like, it's just sort of, it is, It's like Day by Day from Godspell.
Yeah,
like,
right.
Eventually, you have to come into the audience because the song's got 2 minutes left, and there's no other words. We're all out of words.
Well, so that's exactly what I want. I want Jesus. I want hippies. I want Jesus hippies to assault me. That's what I want from theater.
That's why I paid $100 for this ticket.
Oh my God.
But then we get into I Could Have Danced All Night, and it does, because this scene goes on for quite a while. It's a funny little sequence going from the servants' chorus. The poor Professor Higgins, to Rain in Spain, to I Could Have Danced All Night. It goes on for quite a while. Like, there's a long chunk of time that the show covers with these three songs. And her, I do, and the nice show conceit that once her voice clicks, it's clicked. It never unclicks. She sings, and now Julie Andrews gets to sing I Could Have Danced All Night.
Yes, I know. It's very important.
Her full Mary Poppins.
It's very danced. It's very important that it's danced. And my favorite thing is exactly the thing you pointed out earlier, which is the counterpoint provided by the maid chorus, the staccato, the main melody is lovely, but it's that little staccato that takes it to the next level. They're like little, like the song is a room, and they're little mice along the floorboards.
Yeah, they're like in Cinderella. Trying to get her undressed and into bed.
It's so much fun.
Could have danced all night. I could have danced all night. And still have begged for more. I could have spread my wings and done a thousand things. I've never done it before. I'll never know what made it so exciting. Why all at once my heart took flight. I only know when he began to dance with me. I could have danced all night.
I understand, dear. It's all been grand, dear. But now it's time to sleep.
And it's got a lot of heavy lifting to do that song, because we have to believe that she's fallen in love with this dick.
Yeah.
And, It's without that the second act doesn't work. Without that, a lot of what we're about to go into doesn't work.
Right.
The song that I've been listening to the most since coming back to it a week ago is the next one, Askat Gavat.
Really?
I love this song. I love the performance of this song. I love the ensemble because of the way they are chewing the bloody hell through these pronunciations.
Is gone. Everyone who should have been gone is gone. What a snatching, positive redemption spectacle the Ascot opening day. At the gate are all the horses waiting for the queue to fly away. What a gripping, absolutely ripping moment at the Ascot opening day. Pulses rushing, faces flushing, heartbeats speed up. I have never been so keen on. Any second now, they'll begin to run. Hark, a bell is ringing, they are screaming. Forward look, it has begun.
I love it. It's two Yanks making fun of the Brits. Uh-huh. Making fun of the aristocracy, and when you get to the way the word, the first syllable of opening kind of stretches out for day, Ascot opening day. Oh, God, I could just love everything about it. Love it. And, you know, there is a visual joke to the song where the horses go by and they remain perfectly still, and then they say thrilling, smashing, wonderful. It's low-hanging fruit. I'm not going to say
it
is.
It is. It is.
But, oh, it's so much fun.
That's good. It reminded me on this listening of, I don't know if you're how familiar you are with Super Ego, but with Matt Gorley's M.
British am I?
How British am I?
Yes. How British?
On a scale of H to Z.
Oh, Bond, you made me so happy.
So happy.
Uh-huh. Yes. Very familiar. Deeply familiar.
One of the interesting things about Ascot Gavotte for me is that you find out that how much Henry doesn't belong anywhere.
That's true.
He doesn't, you know, it's not only that he despises the the lower classes because of the way they speak or any of that. That is certainly part of his life. But then he goes to a place full of people who couldn't talk better if they tried. And he's not dressed appropriately. And his mother is there and who says, "Henry, how disappointing," which is such a lovely first line for anyone. And she hates that he's there. And he doesn't like being there. He is not interested in these people. He doesn't like what they're selling, and he's not buying anyway. And he just sort of throws Eliza in the middle of it. She makes a big mess, a big fool of herself, and scandalizes everyone. He just thinks it's hilarious from top to bottom what she's done. And he's really antisocial, is our Henry Higgins. Like, in a really it's a good scene to let you know, he doesn't belong in any place. Nobody likes him. He's no good. He's like Sherlock Holmes that way. He doesn't fit in anywhere he goes, but he just has a very nice accent.
Yes, he does have a very nice accent, and he can talk sing. But, like, this is one of the reasons I think I identify with him, is because, like, that scene is intended to make us feel some empathy for him because he is eccentric. He doesn't fit in, and he is, importantly, not hung up about it. Doesn't care. Like, it's his terms. You can't even call it privilege what he has. It's something. It's like six steps beyond privilege. But that notion. I think what I really admired about the guy is that, like, he doesn't fit in at the flower market. He doesn't fit in at Ascot. He's doing his own thing, and he doesn't care. He doesn't care.
Does not care.
It's a lack of issue. It's not an issue. It's a great thing. And now we come to a song I hate. Absolutely hate. Absolutely hate.
Hate. That is a strong word, and you haven't used it yet. Hate on the street where you live.
And all the towering feeling just to know somehow you are near. The overpowering feeling at any second you may suddenly appear. People stop and stare, they don't bother me, for there's nowhere else on earth that I would rather be. Let the time go by, I won't care if I can be here on the street.
Stops everything dead in its tracks, right? It's just this ballad, and it's sung in this very old school, almost operetta, I guess. It's just OG. Mm-hmm.
Oh, it's very operetta. It's like Gilbert and Sullivan all of a sudden. And Wandering Minstrel Eye,
truly. Yeah. And when we get to Show Me, it has a counterpoint where Eliza comes in and says, "Get rid of all this. This is," and I feel exactly the same way. I want Eliza to come in and say, "Could you stop now? A little backstory here. My mom worked at the high school that I attended. I don't recommend that as a life plan. Any kids
out
there?
They're considering it.
If anybody considering it, don't do that.
You heard it here first.
And for every day of those 4 years, she loved that school, and I did not. And she was trying everything she could do to get me to have school spirit kind of manifest on me like a rash or something. I don't know. She was like, go out for a sport or, you know, join the marching band, join a club. And then when we drive together to school in the mornings, yes, we drove together. Don't make a big thing of it. I'm not on trial here. I'd be essentially lip syncing to every song on My Fair Lady. And I didn't think anything of it. It was just a thing I did until the spring of my freshman year, when my school did My Fair Lady. And she was like, come on, you have to try it out. Yeah, try it out. Yeah.
Right.
You know this thing backwards and forwards. But that flew in the face of my core belief. My entire organizing principle in high school was to was how much energy I was devoting to being invisible, to getting through it, to making no ripples. I mean, also, you know, not for nothing. I knew I can't act, I can't sing, I can't dance. That was a big factor in it. But my introversion was just at its apex at that mm-hmm. moment. And sure. you know, and by the way, you know, when actors say, "Oh, I'm really an introvert," I'm like, "Well, then you didn't read the manual, because that's not what you're doing there. It's not what introverts do." And they're all like, "Oh, but I'm playing a character I can hide in. It's not really me." And I'm like, "You are insane. You are putting yourself out there and people are pointing at you. It's you, dude. It's, I don't know what you're thinking." So yeah, I don't get that. But we fought and fought and fought, and I won. I didn't do it.
Ultimately, you would have to go audition, so you have the final, like, nope, not doing that.
Yeah. And that's the thing. And I'm still glad to this day I didn't do it. I just don't think I'm cut out for that. And I know I would suck. Also, I wouldn't enjoy it at all. I would feel so self-conscious. I'd be paralyzed with self-consciousness. Now, I did go to see it, however.
Oh, sure.
And it was, you know, of course, it was like in our school, it was the popular kids who did pretty much everything. They did the sports, they did the committees, and they did the theater. It wasn't like theater, wacky theater nerds, like weird theater mm-hmm. kids. It was all the popular, well-scrubbed, you know, lantern-jawed kids. Same kids who did the Music Man. Look, it was always the same mm-hmm. group.
Yeah.
And it was terrible. Oh, my God. the accents were all over.
Like, oh, well, yeah.
I mean, and the band was off, and the kid playing Alfred E. Doolittle was a huge hit because, again, hardwired into
it. It's hard. I'm telling you.
But he was phoning it in compared to compared to Holloway.
There's no animus to his character. He hadn't really thought about.
He
know,
hadn't lived.
London dustman? You know, what is that life?
That's
what
right.
is that? What is that experience?
And it was like a kid who had like been drunk on Jaeger, but he hadn't been like, you know.
Sure. Right.
had
he's like been a very good drunk, but he
yeah. But the kid who played Freddie, Patrick, he totally beefed it. It is a tough song. It's got a big range.
It is a tough song.
But you
That's
don't
a tenor, real tenor song.
Real yeah. tenor song. And you don't want to pair a song that is that difficult with so many sudden high notes with puberty. Because
No.
His voice cracked from the second bar. Like, but the pavement always stayed beneath. As soon as he was like, but the pavement always stayed beneath my feet before. Mm-hmm. When he was there, everything
yeah.
was fine.
It was fine. Yeah, yeah.
But as
now
soon as
you've got to jump the octave. Yeah.
As soon as it all at once, crack. Just like into 1,000 pieces and the pavement
shattered
beneath him. And the crowd, and that's even before, like, he's got, you know, once, am I? And then there's something
right,
else at
yeah,
the end.
There's a lot to go, towering like, feeling. And,
the crowd was at first still. Like you can't believe this is happening, aghast. You could notice that he was flailing. He knew it. You could see the terror in his eyes and the flop sweat because he hadn't finished the first verse.
Right. Song's 3.5 minutes long.
Three and a half minutes long. And of course, what's going to happen in an audience full of snot-nosed punks who have no empathy because their brains are tiny? They started giggling. And it got louder and louder. And the more that the teachers and the parents were just got bigger and bigger and bigger until he was cracking on the low notes, too. It was awful.
Man.
Unforgettable. Oh. I didn't need reinforcement. Yeah, you shouldn't have auditioned. But anyway, it's a cheesy song. Hard. It's a flowery song. It's intended to be. It's intended to be an extension of Freddie's kind of childish romantic notions. I get that, but oosh, boy, I just don't. It's such a slog for me.
Yeah. It also has the worst lead-in line to a song in this show, because he runs into the cop, if I'm not mistaken, right before the song, and the cop's like, what are you doing here, or something. He asks who lives here, and the cop tells him, and then the cop's like, leaves, and right before, for some reason, the response to whatever the cop's line is, as he goes, it's okay, I want to drink in the street where she lives. I'm just like, anybody would be like, well, you're under arrest. I'm terribly sorry.
That's right. That's exactly
frightfully sorry, old boy. I'm afraid you'll have to come with me then.
So we haven't invented stalking, but we're about to.
Excuse me, are you a peer? Well, then you don't have to come with me, so I'm terribly sorry.
Yep,
right.
yep.
This is what we call protective custody, and until you go up to Oxford or wherever, you're coming with
me. It's what the dude does to Joanna in Sweeney Todd. It's the same deal. It's like, nope,
it is.
Still creepy. Nope.
Still creepy. Still super creepy. Right. Mm-hmm. But, and both of those, I mean, both of them get their sort of comeuppance a little from their romantic intake. Mm-hmm. Eventually, of course, but this is a funny show for me, especially of its period, because structurally one of the weird things about it to me is that it does not have an act one or act two finale in the traditional musical sense.
Right.
There is no Wells Fargo wagon in this show. They go to the ball. There's some dialogue. There's a lot of music. I mean, it's a big, you know, the ball music plays, and then she runs into Zoltán Kárpáthy.
that dreadful Hungarian.
Greatest character name in this show.
Yep.
And they go off to talk, which is the big thing we've all been nervous about. And then that's the end of Act One. It is just, and then the curtain comes down. And it's just so, it's such a shocking little moment. And then to repeat it in Act Two, basically, when we have, you know, he has his big song, but then we have a book scene to end the show. It does not have a musical moment.
Are you ready, Patrick, for my hot My Fair Lady take?
Ooh.
My hot dramaturgical take.
Yes.
Okay.
50, 60 some years in the making. Here it is. Whenever the show came out.
Do not show us the ball. We don't need to see the ball. Take it out. Take it out.
Sure.
Because you are only going to recap it beat for beat in song.
At the top of Act 2. Yes.
At the top of Act 2. So don't bother. We just saw everything you're singing about happen slowly. We don't.
Very slowly.
Don't bother. It eats time. Like, I didn't realize how long it went in the movie, but that is just like, that's like 20 minutes of screen time of just people curtsying and then you get exactly that. And what matters is how these characters feel about what happened, not what happened, right?
Right.
And the song is them expressing it. The song is their delight. They won. I think you shave that off. Have, what would it be? It would be, I guess Straight Where You Live would be a lousy song to close Act 1 on.
Well, you close on the scene. I mean, if you're going to do it anyway, if you're not going to have a closing number, you close on the great, I mean, and it's again straight out of Shaw, the scene of Pickering, you know, drinking several glasses of port because he's terrified. And Higgins acting very like, oh, it'll be fine. Don't worry about it. No big deal. And then after everyone has, Eliza comes in her dress and they're all stunned by how beautiful she looks. And they walk out and he turns, Higgins does, after everyone's left and downs a glass of port and then goes out. That's all you need to know.
Right.
You know that, yes, he's actually a little nervous about how this is going to, he cares how this evening goes. And after, you know, and for many reasons, he cares. And then, I think you're right. I think he walks out of the room, you put the curtain down, and that's it. Then we come back with, you did it. We join, pick up right where we left off, 3 hours later, whatever it is.
Exactly. You save a scenery change, you know? You don't need to put a chandelier down or anything.
You don't need that staircase. You don't need all those tuxedos. You don't need Zoltán Kárpáthy, who isn't going to do his thing. I mean, it's such a funny, the reason I this is the song. You Did It is the song I skip. Skipping songs, I'm skipping You Did It. It is very, very long. Like you say, it is a recap of something that happened off stage. And that whole middle section explaining what Zoltán Kárpáthy did, I never thought of it this way before, but you were like, if you're not going to show me, you know, the oldest drama writing tip in the world, don't tell show. This is nothing but tell for a very, very long time.
Oozing charm from every pore, he oiled his way around the floor. Every trick that he could play, he used to strip her mask away. And when at last the dance was done, he glowed as if he knew he'd won. And with a voice too eager and a smile too broad, he announced to the hostess that she was a fraud.
No.
Yavol. Her English is too good, he said. That clearly indicates that she is foreign. Whereas others are instructed in their native language, English people aren't. And although she may have studied with an expert dialectician and grammarian,
I can tell that she was born Hungarian. Not only Hungarian, but of royal blood. She is a princess.
Because importantly, because the most important part of it is the fact that everyone ignores Eliza.
Yep.
After she's the one who actually did all the work.
Yep, yep, yep. And the show knows that, and Shaw knows that, and, you know, Lerner and Lowe know that. And the only people who don't know that, the audience knows that, the other people who don't know that are Higgins and Pickering.
Right.
I think the maids know that, too. I think the maids are like, what
I think Mrs.
going on
Pierce
here?
Knows, yes.
Definitely,
right.
Yeah.
But we work for this guy, so we're going to say congratulations.
Yep. And then, as you say, Show Me is exactly what you want. It's mm-hmm. something starts out very frilly, and she's just, you know... She think of Julie Andrews as Cher in Moonstruck. Snap out of it. This is all that's happening.
Mm-hmm.
And what I love about this is now that she's gotten everything she needs to get from Higgins, she is totally in command of her affect, and she's fluid with it, right? So she can be the pinnacle of it, which is anyone who's ever been in love will tell you that. This is like that little the EH before the TH is exact. This is Newt. Like it's perfect. And then, you know, haven't your arms hungered for mine? Please don't expline. Show me.
Yeah.
She can go back and forth.
And slip in. Yeah.
She can do it. She straddles London like a colossus.
Sing me no song. Read me no rhyme. Don't waste my time. Show me. Please don't implore, beg or beseech. Don't make a speech. Show me. But never do I ever want to hear another word. There isn't one I haven't heard. Here we are together in what ought to be a dream. Say one more word and I'll scream. Haven't your arms hungered for mine? Please don't expline. Show me. Show me. Don't wait until wrinkles and lines pop out all over my brow. Show.
Because she needs to have agency. This show would be so depressing if she didn't. And everything the setup is a dramatic power differential, and that is her way. And again, the rage, the resentment, the please, you know, stop shoving words at me. I've had enough words. I'm so sick of words.
Yeah.
That is important. That is her stake in a claim. And I love it.
Yeah, and I like the song that doesn't happen right before Shirley starts, when Freddie starts to sing.
Speak and the world is full of singing, and I'm winging higher than the birds. Touch and my heart begins to crumble, the heavens tumble, darling.
Oh, words.
It is such a great Brigadoon-esque number that they
Absolutely.
Decided to parody themselves for a minute and then have her just cut it off entirely, and it's not even something we're going to talk about anymore.
Yeah.
Going to have to move on.
Let's move on.
Great.
That's my motto. Move on, Freddie.
Move on, right.
Keep
her. And she does. She pulls him right out of there, and that's the end of that, right?
That's the end of Freddie.
Right. Well, except where does he go, I guess, because then they go to the flower market again for Wouldn't It Be Loverly reprise, and... Get Me to the Church on Time. Our big 11 o'clock number here.
I was going to ask, this is the dictionary definition of 11 o'clock
absolutely.
Number, right?
Absolutely. Oh,
this
absolutely.
Is it. Mm-hmm. This, I mean, the Oompa band, the Oompa, like, beer house vibe is meant to get the people moving, swaying in their seats with sheer delight at this, at this jerk.
Oh, I'm getting married in the morning. Ding dong, the bells are gonna chime. Kick up a rumpus, but don't lose the compass, and get me to the church, get me to the church. Be sure and get me to the church on time.
It's a funny character in terms of comedic, you know, situation, because he's in Doolittle, shows up for With a Little Bit of Luck. There's a book scene after that. Then there's a reprise of that song. Then he goes to Higgins and extorts the money politely. And then he's gone. He's not even referenced again. And then he pops up in the middle of Act Two to sing the big show-stopping number of the entire show, and then he's gone again. Like, that's it. That's the last. He's carried off stage, and that's the last time we see him.
And the primacy of his experience over this woman he's marrying, who do we don't really meet her, or
never.
Do we even
she's never on stage. Nope.
See, wouldn't it just dramatically? Shouldn't it be Mrs. Pierce or something? Shouldn't it be some woman in the cast so that like there's things tie up? It's not just this random guy showing up randomly going, "Hey, by the way, getting hitched."
Well, it's like, the funny
couldn't
thing.
Couldn't it make sense to be not maybe Higgins' mother? Maybe true love conquers all.
Oh, that'd be funny. It is that thing of because when Lerner adapted the play, most of what he did was simply take the scenes and just retype them.
Right.
But there was a decision made that since the entire play takes place in Higgins' drawing room, unless I'm mistaken.
Oh, sure, yeah.
That they have to open up the world. They want to go to Covent Garden. They want to go to the Ascot. They want to do these things. And so they decide to take these Doolittle scenes out in the street for a little bit and see him in his element. But they don't really want to create any new characters. He's got his two buddies with him, but they're pretty much stock Cockney guys that he can talk to. And the bartender has a few lines. But otherwise, it's just Doolittle being Doolittle and waxing philosophical. And so I guess, you know, the impetus would be we don't want to see, if we have to show his wife, we have to then create the character of his wife and decide what that relationship's like and decide makes it all kind of real. And I think that the decision is just like, nah, like just best leave her unsolved.
Right.
You know,
there are
over there.
There are, as Ian Forster famously wrote, there are flat characters and there are round characters. And it's okay for this guy to be flat, I guess. It's okay for him to have the one thing that he do.
Yep.
And I'm sure you invested him with all kinds of, with an inner life, a rich inner life.
I did. Yes. Well, and also because with Shaw, so many of his characters are simply representations of social classes and people.
Yeah.
Like
the
point of Doolittle in Pygmalion is that he is actually as eloquent and as interesting and as philosophical as anybody who speaks posh. He just has a bad job and is doesn't really care. He just sort of, but he's sort of a, you know, streetwise philosopher kind of character. He can be anywhere. And that's not real. That's his point, basically, is to give that a little depth.
Yep.
And it's that's it. You know, that's all he's. So like, it's not like Alan J. Lerner, Academy Award winning, two-time Academy Award winning screenwriter, didn't have a lot to work with here.
Sure.
So, yes, they just decided instead, nobody will care if we write Get Me to the Church on Time. And they were right. Nobody cares.
Yep, absolutely.
It's a great exit. I'll tell you, Glenn, I've played some parts of my life getting carried off stage while the audience is roariously applauding. It's a great, waving your top hat is a tremendous exit.
I can imagine. And imagine being
peaked
a Rex
at
Harrison.
14.
Imagine being Rex Harrison who has to follow that. Like, imagine being anybody who has to follow that. And with
the
song. So what they do is they trot out the Gay Panic again, and they do this incel anthem volume 2. And
but they do it so well.
But they really do it a lot so well. This is a lot of fun, and the tempo is exactly what you need. It's not competing with Get Me to the Church on Time, but it's up and it's lively, and there's some really good wordplay, and it shows the cracks in the facade. It shows the desperation that has creeped into him.
Why can't a woman be more like a man? Men are so decent, such regular chaps, ready to help you through any mishaps, ready to buck you up whenever you are glum. Why can't a woman be a chum? Why is thinking something women never do? Why is logic never even tried? Straightening up their hair is all they ever do. Why don't they straighten up the mess that's inside? Why can't a woman behave like a man? If I was a woman who'd been to a ball, been hailed as a princess by one and by all, would I start weeping like a bathtub overflowing, or carry on as if my home were in a tree? Would I run off and never tell me where I'm going? Why can't a woman be like me?
He has no idea how nuts he sounds.
Yeah.
In that moment, we all, Mrs. Pierce, but also us, are just like, "Wow, you have lost it, man." Uh-huh. And so he is, as you say, lowered his armor and brought himself down, totally unaware though of how he sounds and how raw he is. Uh-huh. Which his mother then lovingly, not so lovingly, pokes and needles. And what we really get in another good scene is this: her with the mother with Eliza, is that Eliza is. What lovely to be around. That her mother, his mother's, I love her. She's great. She's wonderful. She's smart and charming and erudite and good conversationalist. And, you know, the last time I saw her, she was cursing at horses. And now she's just, you know, she's so nice. Uh-huh. And it's really, because she's not pretending. I mean, the trade in the Ascot scene where Eliza messes up is that she's trying to be posh.
Right.
She's not only using the voice, but she's trying to be posh.
Right.
In after him to him, she's just being herself, just speaking quote unquote better English.
Right. That is that you need this. You need this song where his status is lowering. Mm-hmm. And you need Without You immediately following it, where she is experiencing a moment of triumph and independence.
There'll be spring every year without you. England still will be here without you. There'll be fruit on the tree and a shore by the sea. There'll be crumpets and tea without you. Art and music will thrive without you. Somehow Keats will survive without you. And there still will be rain on that plain down in Spain. Even that will remain without you. I can do without you.
Without You is like Helen Reddy, Eat Your Heart Out. It's, you know, sisters are doing it for themselves. It's a song that's driving itself off a cliff in a convertible. This song is like, fuck you. I'm out of here. And I do not think, if those two things didn't happen in concert, Higgins being taken down a peg, taking himself down a peg.
Yes.
Along with, and he'll do it again in Custom to Her Face. Like, that's the thing. Otherwise, her breaking up with him, essentially, and saying, without you, yada, yada, yada.
Yeah.
They have a teacher-student dynamic, and that needs to end. And the way you do that is by having her leave. And she removes herself from the equation, so, you know, and at the same time he becomes a skosh more vulnerable, you bring them closer to a level playing field. It's not level. It still sucks. But if she just fell into his arms, moy, that would just feel so empty.
That would be so bad.
That's what gives this thing. I mean, the ending isn't perfect, but it does have some teeth in it. It does. It isn't tidy. And it's meant, I think, to send people out of the theater kind of feeling a little like, oh, they're not meant to. You're not meant to go out of this thinking they're destined for each other. You're meant to think they have some work to do.
This is a thing.
This is a thing.
And then he comes out and breaks his heart. He breaks his own heart.
Yeah, and
the damn,
and the way that breed of masculinity can only allow itself to admit something so far. It's not love.
Right.
I've just. It's just it's extended proximity. That should be the subtext. That's like the in parentheses. Extended proximity.
Extended proximity. I like that.
Exactly. Extended proximity.
I've grown accustomed to her face, colon. It could have also been a plant.
Yeah, that's right. I like the
Why
wallpaper too.
Right.
That's right. I'm really fond of this wallpaper.
Right.
So.
Nice. How long has it been here? Right.
That's right.
What is it going on?
Yeah, and you know,
but it is a beautiful song. I mean,
it is a beautiful really song, is. And yeah. He, even in the London cast recording where he's been doing it for forever, he lets himself hit a note for longer than a second.
So used to hear her say good morning every day, her joys, her woes, her highs, her lows are second nature to me now, like breathing out and breathing in. I'm very grateful she's a woman, and so easy to forget. Rather like a habit one can always break. And yet, I've grown accustomed to the trace of something in the air, accustomed
He is playing. I never thought of it that way, but I think you're right that he is playing in that. It feels more like, in the London recording, a performance.
Yeah.
Than sing the song, I Pray You, the way I wrote it. You know, it feels a lot more just like, this is kind of how I do it on Tuesday nights. You know, this is sort of the way I do it. And it's like, oh, that's good. I like that. It's, you know, we're just doing it for ourselves a little bit more.
Let me see if I can get Rise out of Pickering. Let me see if I can do something.
See if I can make Julie Andrews crack.
Play to his backhand. Right. Yep.
Oh, Rex Harrison. Mm-hmm. You such and so. And then we get our scene, our much derided scene, really, I have to say, and derided with cause.
Yeah, absolutely.
I would say. In Pygmalion, he goes home, or he is home, and she doesn't come back, and that's the end. Uh-huh. Kind of a downer. Uh-huh. In this, she does come back, and he says, Eliza, where the devil are my slippers?
I maintain that if you sell a custom to her face and a him-to-him strong enough to show his breakdown, you earn back some of that ending. You earn back a bit of it. You don't earn it at all. It's not, again, not a level playing field, and it needs to be. But again, patriarchy. You know, it's kind of hard to level the playing field with two songs.
Yeah. But, you know, ingrained. It's almost like the patriarchy is built into the very system that created the show in the first place, or something.
The
I don't know.
Devil, you say?
Off the. I had this terribly frothy idea. We should be treating women equally. What do you think about that, Theodore? Right. Frightfully bizarre fellow. Threw him out immediately. Lit him on fire, don't you know? What do you think about this show? I mean, we've talked about it a little bit, but sort of in the more specificity of recommendation to younger people or to people in general, do you recommend this show as something people should absorb, or do you think it is more, it was good for me then, it's got merits to it, but, you know, largely it can kind of drift away?
I don't know. I think it, I love this recording because it is a time capsule. Do I need to go to Broadway to see that revival that they did recently? No, I don't. Because I would be spending my entire time doing, you know, fourth level calculus, trying to figure out what they're going to do to account for X, Y, and Z. And, like, I don't want to, that's not fun for me. It's like, let it be a classic, you know, with all that name implies, which means it's of its time. I don't, there's a lot more exciting things going on right now that I'd rather have something speak to the moment than speak to 1961, you know?
Sure. I got you. So how do you, Glenn, as someone who absorbs a lot of media professionally and then has to expound upon that media, how do you find joy in the media you have to absorb?
Well, I mean, you know, it helped that for 16 years I was in a job I hated that had nothing to do with media. It was basically just being a PR flack. And once I came over to NPR full time, it took a long time for that to happen. Yes, something that my colleagues and I talk about a lot on the show is that we are never not, whatever media we're consuming, it's at least 20% work, which means when we're on our downtime, we are still consuming media that we are going to maybe talk about on the show, not necessarily altogether, but like to make a recommendation. And even when I'm 80% at work, I'm 20% having fun because I'm watching or listening or reading something. And even when I'm, you know, only 20% at work, it's still in the back of your head that you know, you have all this stuff to expound upon. I will say that I did a cultural history of Superman. I also did a cultural history of Batman. That book, The Caped Crusade, was more an analysis. The Superman book was basically like a whistle-stop tour of chronology. Here's what happened, then this would happen. But I got to play around a little bit more and kind of pull some threads and find commonalities and come up with theories about the appeal of these characters in the second book, in the Batman book. And that was awesome. It was also exhausting. And that was 2 years of research. And again, research, reading comic books, reading interviews with comics creators, like that's, right. it's I'm not in a, you know, Victorian workhouse, but
or selling flowers at Covent Garden.
But since finishing that book, it's been tough to kind of just pick up comics, like a thing that was part of my life for just pretty much my entire life is just not a thing that I can do right now because it was such a deep dive. Now, I'm, you know, it's still possible for me to find shows and movies that completely delight me when... And it has to do with something you mentioned, Patrick. It has to do with when they do not adhere to a formula that I've seen before a million times, or when they just execute in ways that feels safe. And in the case of major studio films, that they feel, you know, studio-driven, notes-driven. When something is an individual creator's vision, it just feels, it tends to feel like you haven't seen it before. I left The Lighthouse, the Eggers film, with such rapt delight in a way that I hadn't experienced in a long time, because this was batshit crazy, and yet it was this depiction of utter misery and stunted masculinity, and it was just so beautiful and haunting and funny as hell. So discoveries like that can still happen. But they do tend to have to kind of play to my back end. If it's just, you know, somebody doing the same thing I've seen done before, it's harder to find something. It's not impossible, but that's the job. The job is to find something to latch on to talk about.
Yeah.
And at NPR, especially on the show, what we are trying not to do with this wealth of content out there is to dump on new creators, fledgling creators, people who are just starting out. What we're trying to do is help people curate their time, which means there's a lot behind this. It's interesting. It's chewy. It's challenging, or it's just fun. This, we think, is worth checking out. And when we don't mention something, it's either because we've all kind of checked it out and said there's not much to talk about here because it's something you've seen done 16 million times before. So, like, it's the fact that it's, you know, she's got a new hat. You know, that's not... Right. That's not a thing. It's a challenge, but I mean, I am so grateful for this job. This is a dream job. I understand that it has been my dream job, and now I got it, and it's very precious to me. But not without its challenges, but it's a very unique set of challenges.
This is so wonderful. So you can be found all over the internet. Talking about various things from The Prisoner to Pop Culture Happy Hour.
The Drink Absolute, absolutely, and Pop Culture Happy Hour. Coming out with a book in June, June 29th, which is basically, it's an NPR guide to podcasting. So it's basically, I went around and interviewed a hell of a lot of NPR podcasters, got some of their best practices, got some of the things they think about before hitting record, and used a lot of the stuff about, you know, audio storytelling and... building soundscapes, etc. Sure. And also just, you know, basic interview techniques and sort of things to think about in terms of ethics. But and a lot of technical stuff in there, but basically it is a lot of advice from folks who've been doing it for 10 years now plus. And yeah, that's called NPR's Startup Podcasting Guide, and that's coming out June 29th.
Oh, that's great. And what I do have to ask, because I nearly forgot, what is your favorite song in My Fair Lady?
Huh. I mean, right now it's Asghat Gavotte, but the one I kind of keep going back to, I guess, is, I mean, why can't the English? You can't beat it. Can't beat it. Great.
Can't beat it. Yeah.
Great opening, great song.
It is really, really great. Yeah.
It places you exactly where you need to be placed, and it has there's nothing wishy-washy about it. It is.
You can't beat a Liszt song. Liszt songs are just the best.
Absolutely. And it's so confident and knows exactly what it's doing, and it takes you on a journey. I love that journey.
It does. It absolutely does. This is so great, Glenn. Thank you so much for doing this.
Patrick, this was a delight. Thank you so much for having me.
Look at her, a prisoner of the gutters, condemned by every syllable she utters. By right, she should be taken out and hung for the cold-blooded murder of the English tongue. Meow. Heavens, what a sound. This is what the British population calls an elementary education.
Oh, come, sir, I think you picked a poor example.
Did I?
Hear them down in Soho Square, dropping H's everywhere, speaking English any way they like. Hey, you, sir, did you go to school?
What are you calling me for, a fool?
Well, no one taught him take instead of tyke. Hear a Yorkshireman, or worse, hear a Cornishman converse. I'd rather hear a choir singing flat. Chickens cackling in a barn, just like this one.
Yeah.
Yeah. I ask you, sir, what sort of word is that?
The Original Cast is produced and edited by me, Patrick Flynn. The Original Cast is on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at OriginalCastPod. You can follow me, Patrick Flynn, on all platforms at Unknown Penguin. Enjoying yourself? Leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts and tell the world. You can also find The Original Cast on Spotify, Stitcher, Overcast, and wherever fine podcasts are available. My thanks to Glenn Weldon for coming and talking to me. I'm Patrick Flynn, and I can't. I have rehearsal.
Why can't the English teach their children how to speak? Norwegians learn Norwegian, the Greeks are taught their Greek. In France, every Frenchman knows his language made to Z. The French don't care what they do, actually, as long as they pronounce it properly. Arabians learn Arabian with the speed of summer lightning. And the Hebrews learn it backwards, which is absolutely frightening. But use proper English, you're regarded as a freak. Oh, why can't the English... Why can't the English learn to speak?